the Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Yeah, tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning, and this is the podcast, A View From Afar, and I'm joined, as always, by political scientist Paul Buchanan. And this week, we're going to discuss political and geopolitical symbolism, and it's a kind of a thing that a lot of people got a sense about, have a sense about, but really can't nail down. And it's going to be an interesting show, and Paul's going to define it for us. We're going to go through, look at what kind of examples are around in this right now, and also historically, and we're going to get an idea of how to sift through all of this, sift through the wheat from the chaff, if you like, and also from the point of view of others, you know, like the famous writer John le Carré. He made mention of government symbolism quite often being, as he referred to it, as the theatre of the real. So Paul, thanks for your company today, and What is this political symbolism, and what should people look out for?
Kia ora, Selwyn, in the first instance. And yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. In fact, I've been thinking about it because there's a whole literature on political symbolism. And what we're talking about today is not exactly that, nor is it a subfield of international relations known as symbolic politics. It's a formal theory that specifies that human beings in international relations act intuitively rather than rationally. But that's not what we're here to talk about today. Here we're talking about what I might rephrase as the politics of symbolism in geopolitical affairs, international affairs. And what I mean by that is something different than, to give you some crass examples, Vladimir Putin riding shirtless on a horse in the tundra. I mean, that's symbolic, all right.
Lying back sunbathing, I've seen other ones there too.
Yeah. I mean, it speaks, you know, I mean, it speaks to the audience, and that is true in international relations. But let's say it's not quite that, nor what I'm talking about today is it the symbolic politics of, let's say, the freedom riders in the United States, or what Greenpeace does around the world, where they do these symbolic demonstrations against oil companies and those sort of things. I mean, they're on the spectrum of what we're talking about. But here, we're specifically addressing diplomatic relations, interstate relations, and related things. So, with that in mind, I think we need to understand that the politics of symbolism in geopolitics has to be considered as a type of public as opposed to private diplomacy, because it's designed to be publicly consumed by multiple audiences. It's not just the interlocutor in front of the state doing the symbolism, but their domestic audiences, which are varied, and then other international audiences. So it's a type of public diplomacy, but what it's designed to do is a number of things. It can frame the subsequent narrative about substantive issues.
Yep.
It can be considered to be a form of posturing, where you're laying down a marker in the sand, if you will, for future conversations with whoever the interlocutor is. It is a form of signaling, but it's more than that. It's not just, you know, sending a message. And so what we have with the politics of symbolism in geopolitical terms is a way of stating a case before getting into the hard discussions. And I'll give you an example just off the bat, because you and I have talked about this off camera. And it's the US and People's Republic of China bilateral meetings in Anchorage, Alaska, of about a month ago. Now, these meetings are yearly affairs between the foreign ministers of both countries, and they're hosted sequentially by one or the other. It happens to be that this time it was the U.S.'s turn. Now, consider this. I mean, the layers of symbology here. The U.S. could have hosted it anywhere in the United States. And if it wanted to make things easy on the Chinese delegation, who were in midwinter, they might have hosted it in Honolulu, which is about
embrace, the kindness, the goodwill gesture. Honolulu's sitting there with all the comforts of a tropical paradise. You know?
So. Yeah, you give them the aloha spirit in the interest, because this is a new administration, so in the interest of showing warm relations. But instead,
that didn't
they decided
happen, did it?
To send the Chinese to Anchorage in early March. And let's just say that's not warm. You know, that's not...
Yeah.
It's no aloha there.
It's closer to Vladivostok than it is to Hawaii, you know. So the symbolism in behind that, they're kind of equidistant from Washington D.C. and pretty close to equidistant to Beijing. But the symbolism is cold, isn't it? That's what you're saying here. Cold.
It's cold. So the United States started it off by choosing a site that symbolizes the coldness of the relations between it and the PRC. Yeah. Now, the meetings themselves became a rant fest where the Chinese foreign minister literally at a couple of points apparently stood up and ranted and raved about the United States, talked about the George Floyd case and its human rights records with regards to African-American. He laid it on really thick. And then Anthony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, turned around and ranted and raved about the Uyghurs, about Hong Kong, and what have you. Now, nothing productive was done.
That's out of protocol to a degree, too, that at the front end where the grievances are placed out there, isn't it? That's not always case in these type of things.
Yeah, but what was interesting about this, I mean, there was no attempt to be diplomatic in the beginning, but you're absolutely right. The initial statements tend to air dirty laundry and what have you. But remember, this was a new U.S. administration, and the Chinese wanted to make the point that things have changed, and not in the way that the United States may prefer, that as a result of the Trump interlude, as the result of the U.S. withdrawal from the world stage during the Trump administration, the United States has to look at China as a peer competitor more than anything else at this point, that they are peers. And Blinken, in turn, wanted to reassert the fact that the United States still remains the dominant superpower, as much as you and I may be skeptical about that, but he wanted to, you know, assert the fact that the United States isn't going anywhere and is going to reclaim its rightful position at the head of the table.
Yeah, we've talked about this. We've talked about that element, that's where the United States wanted to pick up, where basically Biden's wanted to pick up where Obama left off, as if the last 4 years don't exist in some respects. So this is all the posturing around that, you're saying. The symbolism is accentuating that message. Who's the audience? Is it domestic? Is it global powers like China and its people, its diplomats, or is it a mix of both?
Well, it's a bit of a mix, but I think that on the Chinese side, most of that was for domestic consumption. To let its people know that it is a big player on the international stage, and it's not going to be bullied by the likes of the United States. So I think they were mostly playing to their home audience. The United States was not. I mean, the interesting thing is that the Secretary of State, I doubt very much, considered U.S. domestic reaction. China bashing these days in the United States, unfortunately, is pretty common. There's no need to exacerbate tensions on that front. when Asian Americans are being attacked in the streets and that sort. So for the United States, it wasn't so much the domestic audience. What it wanted to do was play to the larger international community and basically say, we're back.
On that point too, we saw after this bilateral. So in the last 2 weeks, we've seen the United States building a coalition around the world, including the European Union, the EU nations. We've got Britain, we've got Canada, we've got Australia, and building that coalition, which is critical in the extreme towards China's actions against the Uyghur people in a province of which it controls. So the symbolism all around here, we're seeing also what could be, it'd be interesting to see what your view is, what could be regarded as China's response to this. And I'll just bring this up on screen here, Paul, and just play this clip.
Establishment of diplomatic relations between China and Iran. Well, China is Iran's long-standing ally and one of its largest trading partners. The two countries are believed to have shared an annual trade worth at least $20 billion in recent years. In 2016, Tehran and Beijing agreed to boost that more than tenfold to $600 billion over a decade. Now, both nations have strained relations with the U.S. and are under sanctions imposed by Washington.
So just on that point, Paul, I guess the point I'm making here is China has not just sat back and passively kind of taken this. If the United States is building a coalition in its favour, and the symbolism's wrapped around that, China, it is responding in kind. And this signing of this deal with Iran is hot on the heels, if you want to put it in that way, with similar kind of open, overt relationships that it is accentuating with the Russian Federation. So it's almost like we're getting to a point where is it an ally and an axis type situation, Paul?
Let me broaden it out a little bit before I get to the specifics of this particular relationship. We have to remember that in transitional moments in international relations, symbolic politics actually are more frequent, are used more often for a variety of reasons, but it's because the global system is moving to another shape. Again, we've talked in the past about how we've moved from a unipolar world where the U.S. was the so-called hegemon to now an emerging multipolar world. And so in this moment of transition, because we still don't know what the stable multipolar world will look like, we're still moving towards that end state, then the politics of symbolism become very important. Now, you brought up the new deal between the Chinese and Iran. This is very important because within that multipolarity, the Chinese are doing something rather extraordinary. The assumption, of course, of stable multipolar systems, and let's say for the sake of argument that the one that's emerging is the U.S. as a declining superpower, China as an emergent superpower, Russia, to some extent, Germany, perhaps, that the constellation is one of, states moving up and states moving down. And the Chinese have decided that they are going to actually fracture whatever multipolar world emerges into ideological camps. Those that support Western liberal democracy, which the Chinese and others now openly say is a decadent system of governance, rife with corruption, that all it does is put a Band-Aid on society's ills without addressing them. And again, they point the finger at the United States as an example of all that is wrong with liberal democracy. And, they have a point there. They're building an alliance of what the West calls autocracies, what they will call efficient governance. And so they're cutting deals with the Russians. They are cutting deals with Iran, or they're expanding. They're even trying to make inroads with the Saudi Arabians, who are chafing under the criticism of their human rights record, and that the Chinese come in and they're very pragmatic. They say, look, we don't care about your human rights record. We just want to get along. We believe in self-determination. And so any of this outside barking from the sidelines, you know, quite frankly, should be ignored. We'll deal with you as, again, as partners, rather than tell you how to, you know, run your affairs.
I'm thinking just on that point that it almost appears like that's a wedge because of the relationship that goes back a long time between the United States-led interests of the West and Saudi Arabia, for example. So you're picking up a distinct move by China of efforts of rapprochement, for example, with Saudi and saying let's get on the same page here.
Yeah, I mean, not only are they chipping away at the traditional U.S.-Saudi relationship, and they're doing it with others. I mean, the Chinese are being friendly with President Erdogan in Turkey, again, another autocrat. You know, for them, it's a matter of efficiency and building an anti-Western coalition. I don't like to use that phrase because I'm trying to put myself in the Chinese shoes, but they can see how this emerging world is going to be carved out. And they want to get out in front. And if they can diminish the U.S. influence in the Middle East by developing partnerships with the Sunni Arab world, and B, acting as an interlocutor between the Sunni Arabs and the Iranian Persians. See, one thing that China has in its favor is that the Iranians trust them. The Iranians, if the Chinese say, you know, we'd love to be able to act on your behalf in international forums regarding your nuclear program, regarding your relationship with your neighbors, do you think it would be of any help? Well, quite frankly, it would be of great assistance to the Iranians, not for their own sake, but in terms of the stability of the region. So they're making inroads into this emerging multipolar world. And they're carving out, I mean, unfortunately, some seem to think that this may be the beginnings of a new Cold War between a camp led by the Chinese, backed by the Russians, versus a camp led by the United States and the UK versus them. And that we could wind up with the sort of detente that we had, from the late 40s into the 1980s. One would hope not. That would make us a bipolar world with two different constellations, but never, you know, based on a balance of power. But nevertheless, what we're seeing is a lot of jockeying. And all of that is being, the lead of that jockeying for position is being done symbolically, you know, by exerting a presence in places never seen before and that sort of thing. So we're going to see more of this on several fronts.
So those, that's the big playing examples of this political symbolism that you picked up around the world. And just looking around, you know, things that are obvious in the last month, for example, up in Belarus, where the authoritarian Lukashenko, the leader there, is under intense pressure from his population. This is in the wake of a popular vote, of which Lukashenko was seen to have won by over 80% of the vote. And of course, the population is saying, hey, come on now, that's not the case. Clearly what's in evidence here is an election that is truly stolen. Lukashenko, as I was saying, the last 2 weeks, we've kind of noticed he's walking around with a Kalashnikov under one arm. He walks into the government buildings of which he controls in his state apparatus and authoritarian kind of expression of government controls. He's got a Kalashnikov under his arm, and as he goes in and as he comes out, you know, these symbolisms of totalitarian tyrants, if we want to put those kind of labels on, seem to be, you know, I think, Paul, we've spoken in past episodes and certainly, you know, in one-to-ones where the bigger the lapel, the bigger the hat, the closer to an insight into the fragility inside some of these totalitarian regimes. Do you see parallels there, for example? I've just used Belarus as an example, and we'll get on to Myanmar in just a moment.
In international relations, countries, there are countries that are insecure, and so they posture. But when, as you were talking about Lukashenko, I thought to myself, because I'm well aware of the imagery conveyed by the Kalashnikov, but I thought, you know, the best symbolism for Lukashenko is when Putin visited him and shook his hand. Just the picture of Putin shaking his hand tells all audiences that Putin has his back.
Yeah.
Puts everybody in their place.
And it took Putin a wee while to get there. It was almost like he left him out there hanging, and that's a symbolism as well. Yeah.
You know, he wanted to watch how this man coped with the fact that his fraudulent election was called out. For a few days, it looked a little dicey for Lukashenko, but he rallied his supporters, he rallied his troops, and at that point, Putin stepped in, and with a handshake, he sealed the deal. You know, there will be no revolution in Belarus anytime soon, and he didn't have to say anything. He just needed to have that picture taken. The Russians are good at this, by the way. I'm struck by the fact, you may recall this, a few years back, now that the Arctic polar ice is breaking up and the Northern Passage is opening up, and the Russians have been all over that like a rash. Yeah. But as part of that, they sent a diving team that planted a monolith with a Russian flag on the seabed under the North Pole.
Mm.
And the symbolism of that is we're claiming it as ours. Now, they can't enforce it. Yeah, they're basically saying this is ours. We got here first. Look at our monolith. You know, you go 250 feet down. We've been here. You know, it's like putting the American flag on the moon. Yeah. And, of course, they can't enforce ownership of the North Pole in any way, shape, or form unless they want a nuclear war. But the point was, all the rest of you guys need to be aware. We're here, and we've been here for a while. We're here first. And I thought, you know, it's a silly stunt. It's like a teenage stunt. But it's quite effective, and that also played really well at home.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this was under Putin's, you know, tenure, so it makes him look like, you know, an adventuresome guy. There's bound to be video of him in a park and something. Out in the middle of a blizzard, you know, having a hot toddy.
What came to mind just there, too, was George W. Bush on the advent of invading into Iraq in 2003. And George Bush had the helmet on, all the military gear and things looking like the tough guy. So, you know, these symbolisms are real, people. And it's look, we've got a number of comments that have come in from the live audience here. I'll just bring some on screen and read them out, Paul, and see what... you know, our responses are. David Mooring here, he says, in advertising and social media, deception for material gain which harms the consumer can be considered fraud, in David's opinion there. Why shouldn't deception for political gain which harms the citizen be considered treason? And he just adds from that, and I'll bring it up because he's got a second prong to this. And if you consider such deceptive acts made by local nationals to be as serious as treason, shouldn't such acts by foreign nationals be an act of low-level warfare? So, Paul, what do you make of that?
Well, that's interesting. It's a little off. The subject of international relations and geopolitics. But, you know, my view is pretty simple. Politics is the construction of a network of little white lies punctuated with a few big ones. It certainly, I don't think amounts to treason, but it certainly is injurious to the political system as a whole. Again, we've been talking about the lack of confidence in democracy in recent years. And it's because it's increasingly been built on a web of lies by politicians of all stripes. And that undermines the confidence of the general public. And I think there, David is right. It's injurious to the citizenry when they continually get lied to the point that, you know, they don't believe the government when it comes to vaccinations. You know, they go off into conspiracy theories. I mean, that's not healthy for the nation state.
What is healthy is starting to perhaps just think through the obvious, thinking through the premise of what we're talking about today. What's symbolism? What is real? What's the purpose of that communication? What are they trying to convey when that kind of symbolism comes out? Who are they trying to target? And all of those kind of things. If people start thinking in those terms, it's got to be a good thing. So this dialogue, like David here is mentioning here, in 2017, UN has passed the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, given destabilizing effects of outright deceptive propaganda. Shouldn't the UN also outlaw it as well? You know, so what I'm just reading from there is that this type of thing, when you start looking through the veil, if you like, it has people thinking, they come up with their own opinions, and it adds to the general debate. And I just applaud that. And there's, I just bring this in. This is really off message. This is from Leighton Rutt. And Leighton is a good friend of mine. He is up there in Japan. And he's a good man that came from Adelaide. And he used to follow the radio broadcast that I did with Peter Godfrey on the radio stations in Australia. I'm going for about 10 years. So, hi, Sal. He says, hi, Sal. And nice to see you live, so to speak. And it's just good to see you there, Leighton. But, yeah, Paul, let's cross to the mirror. Myanmar issue. If it's an opportunity to do so,
can I say something right before we go to that?
Sure.
I think we need to understand that there's a downside to the use of symbolic politics, and that is it may backfire. It can back the state or the organization using certain symbology into a corner from which it cannot retreat. That's happened more than, quite often, where countries claim to, put a line in the sand, say something is absolutely inviolate, and then they're forced to back away because they don't have the ability to enforce what they say. And that gets to the last point that David made about the UN. The UN can outlaw everything and anything, but it has virtually no enforcement power over the things that it outlaws and so on. So that's the big problem with the UN. Not only is the UN Security Council absolutely flawed and archaic with the veto to the five permanent members, but the UN itself has a hard time mustering up any sort of enforcement capability. And a clear example of that is in Syria. There's been war crimes committed on grand scale. Their chemical weapons have been used. Civilians have been wiped out, in droves. And the UN has done, nothing, absolutely nothing other than bark about it. So the key to symbology is that following the symbolism, there's got to be something of substance. Mm. And that's where a lot of actors failed to materialize.
With respect to the UN has long been criticized for often sitting on its hands, some would say, and that's the appearance that many in the population would see. The Security Council being polarized by different powers that never meet. There's no agreement, so therefore the Security Council is seen to be wanting in many areas. I know that this week the Global Leaders Forum, it's a group of which Helen Clark, a former Prime Minister of New Zealand, is the vice chair of, and Mr. de Klerk, who's he was the immediate president of South Africa prior to Nelson Mandela becoming that president, and some say facilitated a country in crisis toward popular vote. They have written to the Secretary General of the UN over Myanmar and the tragedy that is unfolding in Myanmar. And they're seeking for the Security Council to consider an option, its options, with respect to Myanmar. So let's just bring Myanmar up here and let's have a look. And Paul, let's see what the symbolisms that are unfolding within this tragedy of what we are witnessing right now.
A dash for mercy. A boat arrives at the Thai shoreline, its passengers, injured refugees from Myanmar's Karen state, loaded onto ambulances and rushed to nearby medical centres. Their wounds ranging from burns, blisters, to bruises and cuts from shrapnel. Bloodied and bruised, these people have escaped a war zone, though for some, the scars were less visible.
I haven't eaten anything for 2 days. There was also bleeding from my head. I haven't gotten any medical care for the whole 2 days because we were escaping.
I can still hear the airstrike. I heard aircraft and an airstrike and I can't sleep at night.
Several thousand villagers had fled to the Thai-Myanmar border on the weekend, some hiding in caves in the jungle to escape airstrikes by Myanmar's military. The Karen National Union's pro-autonomy stance angering already tense army leaders.
So, Paul, what do you make of that situation there? There are a number of things that stand out to me, but it'll be interesting to see what your take is.
Well, unfortunately, the military has decided that it's no longer going to play nice or gently with the demonstrators. And I should preface what I'm about to say by the fact that it should come as no surprise to the demonstrators or anyone else for that matter, that this military is capable of killing its own. The genocidal practices against the Rohingya, admittedly a Muslim minority in a majority Buddhist state, is clear proof that they can be quite murderous against unarmed civilians. And I think what's going on here is the military is signaling in this instance to several audiences that it intends to remain in power for the foreseeable future. The first one is to the domestic audience, the protesters specifically. The more they commit these atrocities, the more I guess they're hoping that people will realize that they have no chance of success in overthrowing the military regime and restoring the civilian regime that the military removed last November, or was elected last November and then removed earlier this year. But the other audiences are twofold. It's telling the international community in general that they should just butt out.
Yeah.
That this is an internal affair. But within the international community, they are signaling to their major patrons, again, as you and I have talked about, China, unfortunately, since I lived there, Singapore, Japan, India. These are countries that are major patrons and economic investors in Myanmar. And what the military is signaling to them is, we're going to tough this one out. And your investments are guaranteed. See, if you think about it from those investors' point of view, all this instability is injurious to economic gain. And so they want things to quiet down. Well, the military are offering them the silence of death. You know, yes, we will quiet them and your investments will be secured. And unless the Chinese in particular turn on the military and say, hey, you got to lighten up. This isn't good for business. Unfortunately, I think we'll see many more deaths before things quiet down one way or the other.
You know, the military may find itself in the midst of some fairly staunch sanctions if its most vulnerable point is the gold in its pocket. And that seems where the international community is becoming more sensitive. The symbolisms, as we've discussed, all around to human rights abuses around the world, even if there's hypocrisy on their own shores relating to those claims. So it's an interesting time, and I think we should watch. The symbolisms that stood out to me too, right on the ground there, there's the razor wire by that creek, by that river, that the Karen people are using to get out of the situation of Myanmar control and across to Thailand. Thailand's put up that razor wire, and yet the government of Thailand is saying, that's not our policy. We're not going to send these people back. But the razor wire is a symbol to those people on the ground. Don't cross the river. You know, so the inhumanity toward a peoples that is putting their hand out and saying, please give us a hand, is in evidence there. And the resistance by some of the governments on the immediate border is being neglected and denied them. And then those symbolisms are palpable. They cut to the very core of human rights, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes, Paul. That's the takes that I took from it.
Yeah, I think that what is interesting on the one side is the Thai government may not have authorized the use of razor wire on the border, but the Thai military certainly was the one that rolled it out. So it speaks to the military's disposition towards Myanmar, which I would say is it is friendly towards the Burmese military. I'll point out something else, although, you know, again, we'll see how this shakes out. Years ago, after watching Somoza bomb his own cities in the 1979 revolution, I thought, okay, this is going to be one of the hallmarks for when a dictator falls. He's bombing his own people. There's no coming back from that. And for Somoza, there wasn't. However, we discovered very recently, Assad bombed his own people. I think he would have been done if the Russians hadn't come in and they took over the bombing. But I think that Assad, once all of this clears, is not going to live out a long life as a result of this. I think one way or another, he's still finished as a leader. And I think that the Myanmar military needs to understand, unless there's something very different culturally in Myanmar that I can't quite see, that bombing your own people, which you may think is a deterrent to others and a signal to international audiences of your resolve, is ultimately counterproductive over the long term. And so it's going to be an interesting test of this theory that once you get to that level of atrocity, there's no coming back, even if you cling to power for a few more years, but that you've delegitimated yourself, and you're supposed to be, as an organization, the defender of the nation. Yeah. But by doing these things, you've delegitimated that core principle. And so sooner or later, you're going to find yourself on the outers and possibly in a very murderous way.
Yeah, exactly. Well put, Paul. And let's hope that in the end, human rights actually prevails and that people respond accordingly. Thank you to the audience that has attended this podcast, the recording of this podcast in its live version. And thanks for your company too, Paul. And it's a great insight into political symbolism and how it's deployed all over the place, from right down on the ground to the big global bilateral meetings and multilateral bodies that exist today. We'll be back this time next week, Thursday, New Zealand time, around midday. We look forward to your company again. Until that time, thank you and take care.